This is Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
All right, we're back on the air here at CFAX 1070. Ultimately, Langford is a mystery. At least it has been to me since all this started. But yeah, if you knew that it was 48% canopy coverage, would the debate have gone the same way? No, of course not. If you knew that it was impossible for Langford to actually enact a dust bylaw in the way that I think a lot of folks out there were convinced could be enacted, would you have voted the same way? Probably not. Type the word asthma into the search engine on the Langford Voters Facebook page. It starts coming back. A bunch of them convinced each other that Langford's dust was giving people asthma, which is not how things work. That's not what asthma actually is. It's not an acquired thing that you can get from municipal policy. But like it was just, it was a free-for-all. And it was completely unchallenged, and Stu Young just basically tried to rise above it. And, well, you heard how bewildered he was that night when everything got flipped around the other way. And let's be honest, the city has never been more divided, and it wasn't me that said that. It was the bloody mayor that did on the February 14th, and I called it the Twilight Zone press conference, because you watch it, and it's like, what the hell is going on? And then, of course, well, here's the thing. It wasn't that difficult to figure out who the mystery counselor was, because Goodmanson, and he's on tape doing it, refused to name the counselor, but he continued to use the personal pronoun he. So Goodmanson said, this counselor, his, him, he, even though he supposedly was shielding the identity. There's only two male counselors on Langford Council who identify as men, Keith Ikucha and Mark Morley. So anybody who actually listened to what Goodmanson was saying at the press conference knew that the mystery counselor was going to be either Ikucha or Morley. So there was a 50-50 chance in guessing who it was. I had watched the public debates back and forth between Scott Perry and Keith Ikucha, and I hadn't seen any similar debates regarding Mark Morley. Plus, I just didn't get that sense from Morley. I've never met Mark Morley, but I don't get the sense that what was described would match up with just what I know about him. So it was obvious from just the way Goodmanson chose to release the information in public that it was about Keith Ikucha. And then from there, it was backwards. I couldn't track down Scott Perry for a long time because he turns out he wasn't even in the country at that point, which again compounded the uncertainty. But yeah, it's just one more instance of how, like, there's just and it's the government doing it. It's these horrible implications and insinuations, like the kind of things that if true and if 100% accurate, can ruin people's lives. And they just get thrown out left, right, and center. Like, it doesn't even matter. Like, I was talking to Mike Kozakowski earlier today, and I asked him, I said, are you surprised to find out that Langford's tree canopy is 48% coverage, which is like 20 percentage points better than Victoria and even better than Saanich? I don't want to run down Saanich. It is a lot of agricultural land, farmland, where the trees are not growing. That's not its fault. Saanich has beautiful trees. They spend a lot of time, effort, and money as well on their tree canopy. But Mike Kozakowski, he said, yeah, that doesn't surprise those of us who know the real estate industry, because Langford was really big on the developers paying to have trees replanted.
The industry was aware of that, but nobody wanted to talk to the industry about that, because the industry is required to plant a lot of trees when building new communities, and Langford was no exception. They took the tree replanting agenda very, very seriously, and now we have the facts via City Hall. So it's what we always knew. It's just nobody asked us as to what was really going on. And I mean, there's also the issue of a lot of these trees being young trees. So yep, they're not big, they're not huge. And so visibly, they don't look like they're there, but they are there. And they're growing, and they're growing into healthy trees.
And yeah, that's sort of what this story was. And it's all true. So maybe, you know, someday far in the future, Victoria will get 50,000 new trees, and it will be 40% forest canopy coverage. But right now, Langford has 2,000 hectares of trees. So if you were to just snap your fingers and teleport every tree in Langford into Victoria, the city of Victoria would have 100% tree canopy coverage. Every inch of pavement or open ground in the city of Victoria would be covered by shade by the trees that are standing in Langford right now this second. If people had known that during the election campaign, I think things would have gone differently, but they didn't. So that's basically what it is. All right. Texture 107010. A bunch of people texted me about this. Somebody says, can you imagine what Victoria's tree coverage would be if you only, or if you didn't count the parks. Well, I know, right? And it's, and they'll come up with another thing. The tree equity score is what they're, is what they're clinging to, and they're worried that there's a bunch of trees that are on private land. Okay, yeah, that's true. A lot of trees are on private land, but again, Langford has more trees than Victoria has square feet. It just to compare the two municipalities, and yet it was always framed as if the reverse was true in, you know, the rhetoric. Finally, we have data where we can prove it wrong. I wanted to play City of Victoria stuff, though, because, I mean, they're at it again. Here's what the City of Victoria is doing right now. While Langford, you know, figures out that a bunch of people got a mass delusion imposed upon them about trees getting destroyed. 24/7 camping supposedly doesn't happen anymore. It's 7-7 camping in some parks, and they're trying to end it in two of them. But apparently, they're going to need to create, and I guess the city's going to run them and pay for them. The city, like, no, that's not clear to me yet. Three new homeless shelters somewhere in Victoria in order to accommodate the people that are in these parks. Listen to Jeremy Caradonna talking to his colleagues yesterday. Jeremy Caradonna says he has been contacted by a family, and he said it got under his skin, that lives in Vic West, that is so feeling so unsafe about the park that they live next door to, that they, when they want time outside with the kids, they get in the car and they drive to Saanich because the park literally adjacent to their home has dangerous, threatening people in it who make people feel unsafe. Listen.
I find that really frustrating, frankly. We're asking a lot of Victoria in terms of our pathway and our approach towards densification. We have really steep housing targets that need to be hit. The city, one way or another, is going to densify. And as it densifies, our green space becomes all the more important.
That's totally true. In fact, I may have even argued that once or twice.
That's a place that people have to go when they live in smaller and smaller housing arrangements. Not everybody has the luxury of having a backyard. So it's not okay to prevent people from feeling comfortable in their green space. Similarly, in Vic West, I've had a lot of complaints and concerns from many different entities. I won't get into all of them, but probably the one that got most under my skin was a family who lives across the street from Vic West Park. They've got a kid, I think they're 4 or 5. They no longer feel safe or comfortable going to Vic West Park, so they actually get in their car and they drive to Saanich to use the parks in Saanich, but they live across the street from a park. That's just simply not okay. So I think it's time for us to take decisive action, continue this process of restricting sheltering in parks, and to figure out what comes next, because this practice can't last indefinitely. So I hope the rest of council will join me in moving forward and doing the right thing, holding ourselves accountable, and getting people inside. Thank you.
All right. So how are they going to do that? How are they going to wind down sheltering? And are we going to create, and this would be the City of Victoria, and that's significant too. This wouldn't be a separate nonprofit. At least I don't think it would be. Would it be BC Housing? Are we talking about Our Place or Kool-Aid or somebody else running this? Krista Loughton moving an amendment, and there was some wrangling back and forth about that that I'm not even going to get into because it has to do with the chair being challenged. Three sites around the city of Victoria to be identified for homeless people to be sheltering there. And apparently one of them's going to be for drug users, and one of them's going to be for alcohol users. And just listen to what she says.
It's time to change the system and to think differently about sheltering in Victoria. So I'm asking council to support me in asking staff to identify three sites, either indoors or outdoors, preferably indoors, other than parks, where unhoused people can exist when adequate shelter spaces are not available. This is the first step. Once the locations are identified, staff can plan how they will be managed, as operations are not a role of council. However, for the benefit of the public, I see these sites as being small, less than 20 people. I see them being dedicated to certain groups of people who are already established in unsheltered communities. For example, one site could be for sober people. Another site could be for people who use alcohol, and another for drug users, all with the necessary staff, security, and culturally support appropriate outreach workers.
All right, all with the necessary staff and security. What does that mean, and have we actually established what that minimum level is yet? Did you know that right now Victoria is spending 4 million a year on operations for day-to-day issues to look after the homeless?
The city of Victoria spends over $4 million a year on bylaw enforcement, public works cleanup crews, and parks remediation to manage the day-to-day of unsheltered homelessness without changing anything. I have said this many times before at this table. We are wasting millions of dollars a year only to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. It's time to acknowledge the rudder is broken, the ship has sunk, and it's time to build a new way forward.
I mean, if I had said that, I'd get called a fearmonger and intolerant. But hearing Krista Louten say that, well, what's the alternative? Stephen Hammond had a lot to say. Chris Coleman had a lot to say. Dave Thompson even had some to say. And Susan Kim reminded the bylaw department that it's common knowledge that some people don't trust them. All the clips are coming up. Don't go anywhere.
If it's happening, it's here. This is Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
All right, the city of Victoria was added again. Three new homeless shelters, we're not sure. Locations are being identified right now with staff. Did you know, though, that the city of Victoria right now, according to Chris Alone, this is yesterday, spending $4 million a year on day-to-day operations. That's bylaw, that's public works, that's cleaning up the garbage in the parks on the sidewalks, it's several tons of material per month was being impounded and sorted and in some cases given back to somebody who claimed it or thrown in the garbage eventually. $4 million a year right now. Krista Louten says the ship has no rudder.
The city of Victoria spends over $4 million a year on bylaw enforcement, public works cleanup crews, and parks remediation to manage the day-to-day of unsheltered homelessness without changing anything. I have said this many times before at this table. We are wasting millions of dollars a year only to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. It's time to acknowledge the rudder is broken, the ship has sunk, and it's time to build a new way forward.
Time to build a new way forward. So what does that look like? It seems odd that the Gang of Five, that is not a political party and does not coordinate, they seem pretty sure that it's three locations they need. Not four, not two, not five, three.
It's clear based on the number of people who are sheltering in the city of Victoria and the fact that we know that people do move around from place to place. They are not stuck indefinitely in one place. We see populations grow and shrink in different parks and on streets. And we're going to need at least three indoor or outdoor locations.
See, I'm okay, but Krista Louten wanted three as well.
It's time to change the system and to think differently about sheltering in Victoria. So I'm asking council to support me in asking staff to identify three sites.
Three? Okay, Thompson's like, oh, at least three.
And we're going to need at least three indoor or outdoor locations based on the...
I'm suspicious right off the bat, and apologies if my suspicion is unfounded in this particular instance, but it's like they all knew what to say with the pay raise as well. Like, they're supposedly not coordinating behind the scenes. If there's five of them meeting and discussing policy matters behind the scenes, that would constitute a quorum. They're not supposed to be doing that. We're supposed to see deliberations among a majority of council hashed out in public. Individual councillors can talk to each other. Of course they do, and that's just the way that things are done. But you're not supposed to have a council meeting in private before the actual council meeting. At least that's not what is envisioned as being preferable, certainly, for the electorate.
Based on the knowledge that we have, that you can't just create one big pen and kettle everybody into it.
Kettle everybody into it. What a verb. Stephen Hammond says, remember Tiny Town?
And the reason that I cannot is that thus far, and we use Tiny Town as an example, thus far, we do not get the kind of security for those areas. And therefore, if we do come up with three, at least three indoor-outdoor locations, I know it will be a gigantic hardship on those neighborhoods.
A gigantic hardship on those neighborhoods. Which neighborhoods are they? It could be you. We don't
know.
It
should not be. We want to have something as an alternative to parks, which, of course, no one around this chamber wants, and I'm right up there. But the difficulty is that I have seen that when we begged BC Housing for security, they have not given it. When I asked the minister at the UBCM conference, and then when I asked at another time, and then when I asked senior members of BC Housing, each and every time they said no, and so it was an emphatic no. And when I asked Julian Daly, the CEO of Our Place, what is the money that you're, I shouldn't say the money, it makes it sound like they're greedy or something. What is the budget that they're getting from BC Housing? It was somewhere between, depending on how they worked it out, $1.6 to $1.8 million.
Like, it's just the amount of money that we are spending on this problem is just absolutely enormous. Oh, by the way, Susan Kim ends up interrupting Hammond over the language he's using. She calls a point of order.
And I believe it was annually, as perhaps, as opposed to over the 18 months. And yet, under no circumstances are they coming up with security, even with all that money. I have heard that, as a matter of fact, I got direct information when I finally caught up with my emails, that they have taken, or they have removed the security from outside of Tiny Town, now Caledonia Place, and they've moved it indoors. That's great for the people that indoors. I haven't seen any indication that the people who are in Caledonia Place, formerly Tiny Town, that they have been a problem.
Okay, we're listening.
Shown that when we do this, the people around there will get those supports. And I got to tell you, if I found out when, let's say they come back on June 15th with recommendations, the people around those areas should be terrified. And they have every right to be. Maybe they're not going to be. Maybe it'll be wonderful. And I want it to be wonderful. I want anything that we come up with in which people say, isn't this great? We have a home, or I rent, and you know, these people are clearly way more unfortunate than I am, and so I'm thrilled that they're here, and maybe every once in a while I even go over and take them a coffee or something along those lines and ask how they're doing. And the difficulty is, thus far, with the one example that we've got, that is not happening. And I've gotten lots of emails from people because I'm the liaison for North Park. I'm sure everyone else has got them as well.
North Park, there's been some rough situations in North Park. There have also been some, though, that said that they've had a relatively easy experience. And again, we can debate exactly why that may or may not be. The point is that some people feel very strongly about what has been happening there.
In which people say they are thrilled to have it. Well, that's great, but it's not great for the people who are around there. And when I spoke to one woman who moved and her kids said, Mom, you got to get out of there. And yet she said that was for her forever home. And she moved from there. And now I know of at least one other person that is planning on moving.
One person planning on moving. And it's at this point that Susan Kim raises a point of order.
Her forever home. And she moved from there. And now I know of at least one other person that is planning on moving. And it's not because they are nimby.
I'm going to call a point of order.
Now, did you hear anybody, or did you hear Hammond say that people were the problem there, or was it behaviors? Because Susan Kim calls the point of order right there.
And it's not because they are nimby.
I'm going to call a point of order.
Councillor Kim, I suggest that I know your point of order, but I'm going to say that I am allowing a significant amount of latitude because as I listen to your colleague, he is speaking directly to why he is not able to support the amendment.
It's actually not about the content so much as the language being used.
The language.
Go ahead, state your point of order.
I believe that as a point of order is when it pertains to the information being provided and the language being used that says people are problems is incredibly it denigrates residents. Rather, we should...
I don't think he ever said that. Did any of you hear him say that? Shoot me a text at 107010 if you remember the language that Stephen Hammond used where he said people are the problems. I heard him say that, in fact, it's not the people who actually live in Tiny Town that were the problem. It would often be other people attending that location who would cause the problems and who would have those problematic behaviors. But not only did he separate people from behaviors, he also separated some people from other people, saying that it wasn't necessarily the residents. In fact, when the residents caused too many problems, they would get kicked out. After that point, they might cause headaches for the neighborhood, but generally not before.
The language being used that says people are problems is incredibly it denigrates residents. Rather, we should, I believe, be saying people who have problems or who have difficulties, which then lead to problematic behaviors, rather than individualizing them as the problem. Thank you.
Your point of order.
I don't think he actually did that, though. And Aalto suggests that Hammond keep in mind what was said as a remedy.
Noted. We will identify that it is noted for the record. And Councillor Hammond, I'll return to you with the suggestion that you keep that in mind.
Well, I'll try to stay away, Mayor, from talking about...
I don't think he did, but okay.
...hurting people and cattle, and no one calls them on that. The point is that when there's criminal activity that goes on from people who are brought around to these areas, we do not have an answer to that. And we should have an answer to that. We should have the kind of security that makes people proud that they've got these kind of temporary facilities in their area.
I love that. And I've said the same thing. I've always had the same argument. What if, and for those of you who are, you're fine with the government spending, you're fine with enabling problematic behaviors, and I understand those are two hurdles that some of you are not okay with, understandably. Wouldn't it be nice if one of these facilities going into your neighborhood meant you were going to get so much extra security there that your neighborhood would be better off? Wouldn't it be great if hosting one of these facilities in your neighborhood meant your neighborhood had more resources so that they totally counteracted any negative behaviors? Wouldn't it be nice to reward a street for their compassion in having one of these facilities? It's possible. It's just a matter of resourcing. And so far, government has been unwilling to do it. Imagine if they did. You wouldn't have people living in fear. And Hammond has a clip. He says people should be terrified. He would be if this was going in next to them, given what he knows, given what he's heard. Quick break. More after this.
This is Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
All right, we're back on the air here at CFAX 1070. We're in the middle of another City of Victoria debate. When we last left our, I don't even know how to communicate this stuff anymore. Bottom line, they might be putting three new additional homeless shelters in Victoria somewhere. We don't know yet. Staff has been, and it's not for sure, not by any means, but staff has been asked to locate three areas where Krista Loughton says she would envision approximately 20 people could be sheltered instead of living in the parks. She talked about maybe having one for drug users, one for alcohol users, and one for, I guess, other users. She seems to think that there needs to be three. Dave Thompson says she thinks that there needs to be at least three. Stephen Hammond says we can't promise safety in the neighborhoods around these facilities. We learned that with Tiny Town the hard way. Susan Kim raises a point of order, objecting to Hammond's language. Aalto cautions him or suggests that he stay away from something that I don't think he ever actually did. So if somebody says, hey, can you stay away from that and you're not doing it? I'd say, yeah, sure, I'll stay away from that. I never actually went near it, so that's not an issue.
And we should have an answer to that. We should have the kind of security that makes people proud that they've got these kind of temporary facilities in their area. But unfortunately, they are just sacrificed in the process. And so until I can actually see something that is done that way and not in theory, then I cannot support this process. I would love to support this process, but anything that I've seen thus far has not worked. When we have told BC Housing we want proper security, they do not do it. We didn't do anything about that. And when it is shown that there's even less security there now, and even let's hope that the people that are inside are great, as I got to assume that the people inside Tiny Town were great. For some reason, this facility, as an example, attracts people who cause crime, harassment, and problems.
Now, is it to say that all facilities like this inevitably fail? No, in fact. And Chris Coleman brings this up. It's one of the reasons that I'm so glad that Chris Coleman ran for re-election after sitting out for a term. And it's one of the reasons that I'm so glad that he ended up back at the table, is that he has seven terms under his belt. He is, or I should say Aalto is to some degree as well, but Chris Coleman basically is the institutional knowledge of Victoria Council at that table. The rest of them are the five, the gang of five. They're all new. This is the first time that they've ever held public office at this level. They haven't even been in the job 2 years yet. They've already asked for the raise, which didn't go well. I think reflecting on their inexperience. because there's no way a politician with a couple of decades under their belt would have done that, because they would have had that gut feeling tell them what the public was going to do in response, which, by the way, was entirely justified, fully deserved. Good job, public. Get ready to do it again if necessary. No, Chris Coleman says, remember My Place? My Place was a different operation that actually worked. How did it work?
When we were asked to open up My Place, and understandably, particularly many parents were very worried.
I remember that. Do you know what My Place is?
About Central Middle School and the students there. And My Place actually worked. It worked really well. Now, there was an enormous amount of resources that were thrown towards that.
Headline, January 5th, 2016, My Place Transitional Home opens. Run by the Our Place Society. My Place at 1240 Yates Street offers those who have been experiencing homelessness an opportunity to live in a temporary 24, or no, they, never mind. That was, trying to figure this out. Now, the My Place Transitional Home, was it? Oh, sorry. I was just reading, actually. It was a Google result that put two of them together. It took the tiny town description and it put it in My Place. No, My Place is 1240 Yates Street. And it was a transitional shelter program, 54 pods. It says it offers individuals experiencing homelessness a safe and secure place to live. It says support staff are there to help them meet their needs and connect to services with the goal of working towards permanent housing. It is staffed 24/7 with Our Place Society housing support workers. But what Chris Coleman reminds his colleagues of is that it was an enormous amount of resources. Okay, if that's how we do it, that's how we do it. It's not fair to put a crime factory next door to an innocent family here in Victoria. It's just not. I'm sorry. We either do it right or we don't do it at all. We don't trade lives. You don't destroy one person's emotional and psychological well-being to try to save another's. It shouldn't be zero-sum like that. We should be helping everyone.
And My Place actually worked. It worked really well. Now, there was an enormous amount of resources that were thrown towards that. A lot of good work by Our Place. And some partnerships were made with the school and the school population that was, I think, very beneficial. But it was very, very targeted. I look at this and this amendment just asks staff to bring back at least 3 indoor or outdoor locations. That is absolutely supportable.
However, he also cautions his colleagues that what comes next is not so simple.
But then we get into the next step of what's the impact on those locations. That
is the question, he tells colleagues. That aggregation of what happens when you close down a park, you know that's going to displace the campers that are in that park right now. They're going to go to other parks. Even if you have a good idea of which parks they're going to go to, that can cause problems.
This location and some potential aggregation of homeless citizens in other parks, we've identified 3 of them as being appropriate, 2 in Gonzales, 1 in Oaklands. I'm the Oaklands rep, so I have a litany of... Litany of emails with pictures showing what the adjacent neighbors have to face. They have been, for a couple of years, incredibly empathetic.
But?
They want to see us find a solution, and they've hit the wall.
They've hit the wall, Chris Coleman says. And I think that's a fair way to put it. You know, the compassion fatigue is one term that I've heard used more and more often as we've gone through COVID. But there are people who live in some neighborhoods in this city where the sorts of crime and disorder that we used to report on because it was unusual earlier in COVID, we weren't accustomed to it. It just never stopped. Not for them. They got used to the constant police attending, the constant ambulance calls, the constant fights and F this, F that, screaming in the middle of the night, wondering if it's an injury or if it's just somebody letting off steam, behavioral issues that would be more akin to a facility where somebody would be in a room with a locked door and perhaps padded walls so they don't injure themselves. Instead, playing out in public view, perhaps with children nearby on park play equipment. Like this is what people have lived with to varying degrees around Victoria since COVID hit, and we normalize this behavior. while people like me were screaming, once we do this, we can't undo it. Stop, stop, stop. Not that it mattered. We're now spending $4 million a year to sustain this. And Chris Coleman says his constituents, people he has heard from, have hit the wall. They're done. It's not that they don't want to do it anymore. It's that they can't. They just can't.
They want to see us find a solution, and they've hit the wall.
So what? So what happens next? Is 7-7 camping still being enforced? What happens if bylaw attends? Does that tent stay down for the day? Or do the campers put it back up within an hour after bylaw leaves? That's something that they are seeing. Chris Coleman's going to talk about that. You're going to hear Susan Kim tell the bylaw department that it's common knowledge that many people don't trust them. No offense intended, of course. As well as ask about whether or not the city will pay for transportation for goods and belongings that people have with them in these parks. The answer, of course, is yes. All part of the $4 million a year, right? I don't know. How do we get back from here? Do we get back from here? Or is this just the new state of how things are? Is this just an ongoing cost that we'll be paying from now until forever, and everything we try to do seems to make it worse? I'm not even sure anymore, but it starts with Cara Donna saying something that I found remarkably familiar. In fact, I'm sure I've said remarkably similar things in the past, so I agree with them, obviously. But for him, the one that sticks out in Vic West was there's a Vic West family that lives next to a park, and they've had so many unsafe incidents in that park that made them feel uncomfortable that the kids don't go to that park anymore. They get in the car from Vic West, and they drive to Saanich. Why? Saanich, even though it has the same global economic conditions, Saanich, even though it has the same government of Canada and criminal code, Saanich, even though it has the same provincial government and all the provincial policies and the imperfections, Saanich has different municipal policy. And Saanich never normalized the sheltering that Victoria did. Saanich parks are much safer. And that's just the way it is. Quick break. Back in a moment.
Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070 and streaming on the iHeartRadio app.
Imagine if you were in year four of this. The good people in the Oaklands neighborhood, some of them have been dealing with it that long.
If we're going to do this, then we have to think about the other areas and the impact on our bylaw folks. So I very much appreciate the work that bylaw have done. Particularly recently, I've been giving bylaw and the city manager, I've been sharing lots of emails with pictures, and bylaw have been showing up more often at different times, which is helpful because that reminds people that you're supposed to take tents down at 7 a.m. and not erect them until 7 p.m.
Not erect them, but what is happening?
You're supposed to take tents down at 7 a.m. and not erect them until 7 p.m. That has largely gone by the way. People tend to have bylaw show up, and within an hour and a half, the tents are being re-erected. And that has frustrated the adjacent neighbors to no end because they thought they were relying on a bylaw that we had put in place.
But
now, where in the Oaklands area, there are some people who are contemplating selling their adjacent houses because they just don't want to deal with it anymore. In the most perverse example, a person who is in the medical community.
Listen to this. Listen to what a person had to deal with. They work in the medical community. I assume it was early in the morning because people have to get up and go to work early in the real world.
Now feels threatened because they were verbally abused for taking their recycling out to the curb.
Why? Apparently it was too loud. And one of the unsheltered thought that taking the recycling to the curb was too loud and they should have done it later in the day. But they couldn't. Why? Probably because they had to get up early and go to work to be in the healthcare system and save people.
They were not set upon physically, but verbally, because we are trying to sleep, thank you very much.
Yeah, the homeless are trying to sleep. Would you mind not getting up so early and going to your desperately needed for all of us to be a healthy job in the healthcare system? Like, it's a joke. Like it's like we're trapped in a joke.
That's just very, very hard. And
it's not okay. It's the sort of thing that just destroys the capacity for compassion that so many ordinary people should have by default.
And it's happening everywhere. Most of us don't live next to an encampment.
But the ones that do have had their hearts hardened, I'm sorry to say. And they just have.
But we're seeing more of them. So as we, to this issue, if we constrain and eventually get rid of Irving Park and Vic West Park, you're going to force, hopefully those people will be, the same person.
Oh yeah, and then there's a person actually calls him in the middle of the council meeting. So there's a slight interruption, but he continues.
The reality is, as we deal with these issues, we need to recognize that it took us decades to get into the problem, and it's taking us time to get out.
Although, how much time is too much time? And at what point do we ask for things to go faster? It's after this that bylaw makes representations to council. Susan Kim asks about transportation, and bylaw does that. Bylaw will transport the goods, the property that a camper owns from park to park where necessary, just to try to help that. Well, listen, this is all the stuff bylaw does for the campers.
Given the difficulties that folks might encounter in parks to access services downtown, have there been considerations around transportation and or storage for folks sheltering in parks?
Is that something for a bylaw, or would that be the city manager or public works, or who'd like to try and answer that question?
Through you, Mayor, I'll start because I do know some history. We've certainly provided help with storage. I believe there has been support for transportation and very much kind of a linking to services. So, yeah, that's I think Mr. Sheffield might add more, but I think that's kind of part and parcel of things of how they conduct themselves in bylaw every day.
Mr. Sheffield, something you'd like to add?
Yep. So through the mayor, yes, we do offer assistance with transportation of belongings. We don't transport people. We do provide packing materials.
Packing materials. They'll give you totes so you can move your stuff from park to park. That is how helpful and friendly Victoria's bylaw department actually is. They are compassionate. They are gentle. And they cost a pile of money to do this. It's $4 million a year, all in.
We do provide packing materials, totes, bags, that sort of thing. We have in the past given out bus tickets to help people get from place to place.
Yeah, we have. I remember where those came from.
And we do connect people with other services that do likewise.
So it's basically, it's all the idealized things that we think will make the problems better. And that's what has led to the state that's out there that we see. And then there's Susan Kim, that after you hear those delightful words, she goes, don't take this personally or don't take this as a slight, but people don't trust you.
Please do not interpret this as a slight on your work. It's more so just, it's just common knowledge. People don't.
It's the political narrative my friends and I created to cravenly grab power for ourselves.
Please do not interpret this as a slight on your work. It's more so just, it's just common knowledge. People don't trust you and your colleagues.
Imagine that. Imagine you get called before the council at work. You're standing there, full public view, cheery voice. Don't take this personally, but it's common knowledge. People don't trust you and your colleagues. Really, which people? Like, it's just, it's embarrassing. It should be embarrassing. My biggest fear is that they don't feel embarrassment when stuff like this happens. The ones across the street, I mean. Like how many different ways can the people of Victoria be insulted before 4 years is over? Like, I have a feeling that we're in some sort of a lab and they're inventing new and exciting ways to disappoint us.
It's more so just, it's just common knowledge. People don't trust you and your colleagues.
Well, people don't trust you and your colleagues either, counselor, so I suppose you have something in common with Victoria's bylaw department. Although, if I were to run a poll and pit one against the other, I bet you bylaw gets 80% at least of the public support when it comes to council. Vic PD gets 95.
Sometimes out on the streets.
And oh, so, sometimes. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. She's going to say I took that out of context. He didn't put the sometimes in the end. Sometimes.
And so what sort of mitigating or deflective strategies are in place so that folks can access those bus tickets and those resources without having to interface with folks that they don't feel like they can trust?
So in other words, what are we doing to allow people not to have to look at you and talk to you to get this stuff? Maybe we should instead be trying to build bridges between these communities, but that's never the goal. It's usually spending more of your money to hire their political friends.
Place so that folks can access those bus tickets and those resources without having to interface with folks that they don't feel like they can trust.
Yep, certainly you're absolutely right there.
And listen, and imagine that was you. That was you, and you're representing bylaw at the council table. Don't take this personally. People don't trust you. And they throw in a sometimes later on in the sentence to sort of defray it. And you're like, yep, no, that's right. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to, you know, denigrate myself. I'm going to die just a little inside knowing that the job that I get up every day and I'm proud to do is treated like trash in public. Just casually, by the way, people don't trust you by the government.
Yep, certainly you're absolutely right. There are people who don't trust us.
Yeah, and they're usually bad people who deserve to be in jail. That's my understanding. But then again, we can have our sometimes. You see, if I put a sometimes in there, it makes it okay. At least that's what I learned.
And obviously that's unfortunate, but there are plenty of other agencies out there as well that work independently and with us as well.
And they all have a boatload of money. So anyway, that was a little bit of the back and forth there. Let's see. Oh, and then Susan Kim does a shout-out for the Parks Relocation Coordinator. I don't actually even know who the Parks Relocation Coordinator is. I almost don't want to know. I'm hoping it's nobody with a name that I recognize in terms of being a political friend. Honestly, it's somebody who has been brought on by the city whose job is to do what the city is saying hasn't been done yet. But Susan Kim is springing to their defense here, saying, you cannot see their success. So, Susan, nobody trusts bylaw, or people don't trust bylaw sometimes. Kim jumps to the defense of the Parks Relocation Coordinator. Has anybody even mentioned them at this point? Actually, I think somebody may have.
Shout out to the Relocation Coordinator also being included in number one, because I'm directly connected to people who work.
Yeah, we know.
With folks on the streets who are very concerned about the well-being of folks who are unhoused.
Yeah, that's what they say.
But I do want to point out that the work that the relocation coordinator is invisible.
That means you can't audit it. How can you audit something that is invisible? Yeah, actually, I don't know if that's what that means, but... You know, for her to say the work or the success of the relocation coordinator is invisible is the sort of thing I would say if somebody else was going to ask me how much money we were spending on something that has virtually zero return on investment. It's not zero. You just can't see it.
And so you cannot see their success. And you cannot see the sheltering and the housing that's been provided. And it's hard to track that.
Yeah, it is. That's one of the reasons I was so skeptical about the massive explosion of growth that we had in spending towards nonprofit service providers during COVID, is I realized that you've got like a boatload of money going out the door and it's impossible to audit this stuff. It's just based on what the organization tells you it did with what are in many cases goods and services that are consumed or received by individuals that don't report anything. Or that aren't credible if they were going to report anything. It is almost impossible to audit money in some parts of this sector.
And see the success, and all you can see is the difficulty that folks who are currently still sheltering are...
All you can see is a job not done.
...are facing, and my heart goes out to them, and do I believe that this can be more compassionate and humane? Abso-freaking-lutely.
That's a weird emphasis, whatever.
But has what has been done up until now as a model for this motion in front of us provided humane alternatives for folks who have been sheltered? I think so, and it's...
I don't even know what that means, but we're going to analyze it more after this hour 4 is coming up. Herb will be up on open lines.